From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2010 in Pennsylvania. Anthony Ilonis was despondent about the breakup of his marriage. He took to Facebook and wrote the following, quote, "There's one way to love you, but a thousand ways to kill you. I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts," end quote. It is horrifying stuff. That is just one example. I am not going to read them all. We'll get into some more of it. There are worse. He wrote on Facebook about killing kindergarten students, blowing up law enforcement. This week, the United States Supreme Court has been considering the case. You see, Anthony Ilonis was convicted on four counts of threats to his estranged wife and the FBI and local law enforcement and that kindergarten class. He was sentenced to nearly 4 years in prison, and now the Supreme Court is trying to decide what's realistic and what's not when it comes to threats, what's appropriate punishment. Anthony Ilonis' attorney says this was an emotional person venting, expressing himself, sometimes artistically, but not with a serious intent to harm anyone. The government says it's time to draw the line on Facebook posts that sound like real threats to real people. This hour, we look at what is legal, what is not, how this case could impact what's allowed on Facebook. My colleague Michelle Faust has been following this story. She joins me in studio. Michelle, always nice to have you here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We also welcome for the hour Catherine Cerulli, who's the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center and the Laboratory for Interpersonal Violence. Kate, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Maloof is here. Scott's an attorney who helps other attorneys to turn social media into evidence, and he helps companies ensure their social media is compliant with the law. Scott, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me start with this. I want to be careful about what I'm reading from this case because, again, I know some of it is disturbing, and I'm not going to read the very, very worst of it. But even what you just heard, let me start with you, Scott. What you just heard about a Facebook post, did that immediately strike you as something that should be legally out of bounds? And I know that's what the Supreme Court's deciding, but when you hear someone writing on Facebook about killing a former spouse, a thousand cuts, watching them bleed, etc. Is that venting? Is that a real threat? How does that strike you?
Evan, I think the real challenge here is the word context, in the sense that we saw a lot of amicus briefs, and amicus briefs are merely people who are not in the case saying, we have an interest, court, please hear what we want to talk about and say on this issue. We've seen a lot of briefs about rap artists in this case saying, you know, I use similar metaphors, and so if you're going to chill the speech of this individual, you may affect me. And so I think that the big issue is context. Is it a performance in front of 50,000 people, or is it some kind of post on Facebook? And that's why you saw the court wrestle so much with this, because they could not tell, where do we correctly draw that line? We don't want to protect someone with 50,000 and not protect someone with 5,
right,
if they have the same intent.
Right. And what's interesting, and we're going to be getting into it this hour, when you actually read the individual justices on the Supreme Court, their questions about this to the individual counselors has been very interesting to me, because there appears to be already, if we're inferring from their questions, there appears to be some split in the way they view what is protected speech, what is not, how do you draw that line. And over on SCOTUS blog, where there's some interesting analysis, here's one bit of analysis from SCOTUS blog. Quote, "The case before the court boils down to what test a court or jury should use to figure out whether threatening statements like the ones that Anthony Ilonis made on Facebook are true threats that are not protected by the First Amendment." Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Okay, and let me ask Kate then, when you hear that, again, I read one of Anthony Ilonis' posts. Let me read just another here. He wrote on Facebook that his son will dress up as matricide for Halloween. You know, again, someone might say, well, that's just sick humor. But you couple that with writing about having enough explosives to kill law enforcement. You talk about people going in and killing a kindergarten class. You talk about bloody ends for your former spouse. Is that a person venting, or is that to you something more serious and more threatening?
Well, I think Scott hit the nail right on the head. This is really about context. And in the case of this particular situation, you have a marriage that ended effectively 4 years ago. So this venting that occurred was on the heels of the dissolution of a marriage, which was 7 years, two kids, and an abuse history. So this wasn't a threat to someone that was plucked out of the air, not that I would advocate or sanction that either. I think one thing that's telling from this particular case, and you know, intimate partner violence has been in the media a lot in the last several weeks because of the NFL and other cases that have come to light. I think one of the important things to think about is in this particular case, this is someone with a history of violence who had a protection order issued against them already. And when we look at these Facebook postings, they're global threats of violence. So it's not just against an intimate partner, but against children and law enforcement. And this sort of defies the myth that intimate partner violence victims, partners, perpetrators only go after their partner. We do have a percentage of perpetrators who go on beyond their intimate partner and do hurt other people. So this is a good case.
And before, in a moment, I'm going to ask Michelle Faust, my colleague, who has spent even more time than I have digging through not only this case, but looking into some of the, again, Scott mentioned rap music and some of the justification that is being offered by Mr. Alonis' attorney. But Scott Maloof is the attorney in the room. We may have listeners read some of his posts and say, I didn't know that you were even conceivably allowed to write that kind of stuff. So give me a sense for right now, before the court decides on this case, what's kind of in bounds and what, and I know it's not totally clear, that's part of the point, but how do you frame what is currently sort of allowed and what the possible impact of the court's ruling will be with this Facebook case?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing is, most listeners should be aware that the Supreme Court has traditionally, or at least over the last, say, 70 years, had a pretty strong stomach. They're willing to allow vulgarity, abusive language, especially when it comes to political speech. One of the cases that leads up to this, I believe, is Watts, in which it was a civil rights protest, and they had a boycott. And one of the leaders of the protest said, anyone who violates this boycott and goes into these white-owned stores, will have their legs broken. And so very threatening. And the court upheld the First Amendment defense in that case and said, you can't convict on this because this is the core political action. So that's really where the court comes down on this, is vulgarity, offensive ways things are said are protected when it's a very core, strong political issue. This case is a little different because I think we saw Justice Scalia say that, you know, he was very skeptical that this was a core commentary, whereas bringing this to what we've seen very recently, Lewis Head, the stepdad of Michael Brown, you know, he had a classic First Amendment situation where he was saying, you know, right after the decision of the grand jury came down, you know, let's burn this expletive down. And that goes right back to the core of political speech. Here's commentary on the criminal justice system, on the courts. And yet it was in front of a very unruly crowd. And then, you know, a situation ensued. And so that's where we're coming down as a court to say, what's the intent? What kind of speech are we talking about? Core political versus venting. And then what kind of stomach are we going to have?
So, go ahead, Michelle. I was just going to say, I mean, interesting when we talk about venting versus threats, et cetera. And that's what Michelle and I talked about this morning, is looking at the way that Mr. Alonis' attorney has been trying to frame this.
Yeah, it's coming down to intent. And the interesting thing, this is why I think this case is so interesting, because how does any court look and really be able to read the mind of a person and decide what the intent? Can you talk to us a little bit about what that means legally when it comes down to what is his intent?
Right. Well, there are, of course, two different standards in civil versus criminal. You know, and criminal is the one we're talking about because it was a prosecution. And when you're saying intent, it's, you know, really what's in the heart of that person? What did they really want to happen? And that's why this case is so difficult, because you're concerned with any kind of really violent threat, like a bomb threat or yelling fire in a crowded theater, is that there's a lot of public repercussions to that. A theater would empty out instantly. A bomb threat in an airport would empty the airport. And so that's why that intent issue comes up, because the court's saying there are certain types of speech we're just always going to say in that context not going to happen. But this is that one of, we need the intent standard to pull back the censorship. And so that's why you do it. And how you do intent is you're looking at, again, the context, the surroundings. Even Chief Justice Roberts alluded to it in the argument. He said, well, you're going to look at the computer and you're going to find a lot of things that say, I'm very upset with my wife. But that's how you traditionally do it. All those contextual clues, talking to other witnesses. I'm sure Kate probably has a lot of issues where, you know, intent involves a lot of heart-wrenching family testimony.
Well, and I think that's the issue when you look at, you know, the National Institute of Justice very definition of stalking as a pattern of conduct. It's conduct that's happened over time, and it's not a long pattern. It can be two or more incidents. But I think the second piece of this discussion, in addition to intent, is also thinking about the receiver, right? So in the statute, it's pretty clear that when you have any threat, that the person who's receiving it, a reasonable person would view that they are in harm or that their family is in harm or the another one that they love. And I think that people forget that there's a receiver on this side. In this case, you know, all those kindergarten kids' parents, the law enforcement officers, but also the victim in this case, who left the marriage probably because there was already a history there. And I know we're talking a lot about freedom of speech, and I want to put another area of the law on the table, which is public health law, and thinking about how, you know, intimate partner violence is a chronic health condition, and that when we see these Facebook pages going up and these horrible blogs about ex-wives and ex-partners, that there's health consequences to this stalking behavior, even when there's never a hand laid on the other person. So, you know, I hope we have a chance to talk a little bit about that.
Now, Kate, when it comes down to it, we're talking about the use of technology in these threats, which is going to be decided whether or not they're actual threats. But how does technology play out when it comes to domestic violence and stalking?
I really think that this is the new frontier for intimate partner violence. The University of Rochester Lab, Liv, where I work, we have spent a lot of time thinking about this, and my colleague Christina Smith and I worked on creating a technology abuse scale, because believe it or not, there is no validated scale out there to help a helping professional estimate what the technology abuse might be happening. So even an attorney like Scott, who's meeting with a victim, has to figure out where to start, what abuse has happened and where is it going to go. Those questions include things like bank accounts. Does this person have a geomap tracker on your car? Have they tampered with your phone, computers, emails? Our entire lives are linked to technology. When you have a tech-savvy perpetrator who has infiltrated every single means of communication a victim has, you've not only impaired their ability to have economic freedom and freedom of communication, but you've impaired their safety, their ability to network with their safety providers.
If our listeners want to join the program, have questions or comments, you can do so toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Typically, I don't like to get down too far in the weeds in terms of what individual justices are saying, but I do think they're all raising interesting points that does show some split. I'm going to get into that in just a moment, but first, let me at least ask Scott Maloof the question, are we at least going to have to agree that there's not any easy way to discern intent? For example, if someone posts on Facebook, I wish my ex-wife were dead, and someone says on Facebook the next day, a different person might say, I wish my ex-wife were dead and, you know, I've got the means to see to it. It's terrible stuff. But where it's going to be subjective at some point, where the line becomes, you know, what you want to call venting and what is not allowed as a threat, right? I mean, there's not going to be an easy way to alight upon an answer here. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think, and we saw that in the fact that both attorneys who were arguing, you know, for the government and for the defendant pretty much did not get to argue at all. All they did were answer questions for an hour.
Right.
And those were conflicting questions. They'd say yes to one judge, no to another judge, and it seemed like they were arguing two different points. So it was
okay.
A very hot bench.
Is there a difference, and Michelle and I were talking about this morning, in reading some of the questions that were asked, a post could inspire fear, and a post on Facebook could be perceived as an actual threat. Is there a legal difference between something that inspires someone to be scared and something that could be taken as an actual threat? Is there a distinction?
Yes, and I think so. I think the law is always trying to control or cabin in restrictions on speech, because First Amendment is the, you know, there's a reason it's first. All of our other liberties, all of our other organizations, government, come from that. And so the idea that something made me afraid, you know, and therefore it should be restricted on the First Amendment, you know, we're not happy with that. Whereas a threat, you know, I, the speaker, said something that caused you, the listener, to fear a result would happen or to fear for your safety. That's very different because it's me saying and then promising to act, as opposed to you just read it and you just said, oh, that made me feel bad or afraid.
Kate made the point, and I bet you you made the point earlier that even if most rhetoric does not turn into physical violence, it doesn't mean it has no impact.
Right. And I think the other thing is getting back to the context. So I have some examples of cases I've worked on. Let's say a young woman goes to her car and there's roses on the car. And her partner said to her, the next time you see roses from me, they'll be the same roses that go on your coffin. That to her, the image of these roses on her car, he knew where she was. He knew how to place them. He knew where her car was. Her car was unsupervised or there wasn't anybody watching the car. That raises a level of fear, and that is a threat to her. Even though a law enforcement officer responding to that may say, oh, he left your roses, no big deal. You know, there's going to be different interpretations of that very act based on the recipient's former history and threats made by that perpetrator. So even though there is no ability other than the receiver to tell you their impressions. And when Scott talks about this fear and threat, that's a hard job for law enforcement when we have these stalking cases to be able to know when that line gets crossed. And we tell survivors all the time the best thing to do is document, 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 because you have to establish that pattern. And when you're talking about why roses on your car make you afraid, you have to explain the second sentence. He said, next time I saw them, they'd be on my coffin.
Now, is there a difference then if you get those roses on the car or if you get a tweet with a little emoji of roses? I mean, is there a difference legally? Is there a difference as far as the feeling of threat from the victim?
I mean, I would argue no. And I think that the ability for perpetrators to creatively use technology to skirt the confines of the law has become an art form for many abusers.
But I think that tweet or the Facebook post is a challenge because our traditional thoughts about threat are, I say it to you face to face, I put it on the car knowing you will find it. Whereas the tweet goes out to the universe, the Facebook post goes out to the universe. And that's why this case is so troubling. If Mr. Alonis had mailed the threat or had said the threat, it's a pretty easy case. Whereas his was more out into the ether and it eventually got to his wife. And that's a real challenge. And I think the roses also point to the difficulty of the reasonable person standard. Without that second part that you mentioned, the reasonable person would say, that's not a threat. And so that's why it's so difficult for the courts to say any particular speech, any particular action is outside of First Amendment protection.
Well, one thing that I thought was interesting was Justice Alito said that in some cases, doing something like that, it sounds like you're creating a roadmap for threatening someone and getting away with it. I mean, is that what's going to happen? I mean, are we really in the situation where we have to decide about making threatening speech legal or confining freedom of speech? Is that where we're at?
No. I think Justice Alito's argument there is a bit of a stalking horse. And the reason is you want very clear bounds, what's legal and what's illegal. Because right now, all of us, we're speaking. None of us are afraid that we're going to be arrested. But the grayer you make it, the more questioning you make it, the harder it is to have that very quick, that interactive speech. And that's the issue because, you know, we keep throwing out the phrase threats. Mr. Alonis was arrested because the words he used allegedly violated the statute. He didn't say this, threat, 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 threat. That's the challenge, is you have to leave that room so that I can use my words freely and not be afraid of consequences.
But I think one of the concerns with this is that there has been great debate on the legislative floors around these harassment stalking laws. And not only has there been great thought and great debate, but the evidence that has been put forward to support these legislative changes. And we've had this interstate stalking law since VAWA was passed in the early 1990s. And, you know, it's very, very clear that they're looking for transmission of threats to injure or harm another person the language seems clear to me in the statutes that there's been thought given to this and how this crosses the First Amendment line.
It's interesting. Your reaction to Alito's comments, Scott, is interesting to me. I mean, I think what Alito is essentially saying is, before social media, if you really wanted to get in someone's face, and even if you wanted to scare them and you weren't intending to hurt them, you essentially had to do it over the phone or in person, et cetera. And now you can air that out, as you say, more for the world, for the universe to see. But Alito is asking if that's just an excuse for people, and then they'll say, oh, it was just a Facebook post. It wasn't serious. I mean, you're saying you're kind of diminishing that argument a little bit.
Yeah. Of all the arguments I saw and looked at, that one was the least persuasive to me, because the law needs to be as clear as we can make it. People need to be comfortable in knowing where that line is, not getting close to it. You know, as an attorney, you know, people will ask me, can I do something? Can I say something? And I want to be able to give them the best possible answer. And I don't want to leave them in jeopardy. I'm sure Mr. Alonis would have appreciated 4 years ago somebody walking up and saying, is this the best use of your creative outlets? You know, is this what you should be doing?
Well, and on the subject of creativity, in a moment, we're going to do something kind of rare on this program. We're going to listen to a cut from Eminem. and I'm going to explain why in a moment here. But so that's one question that Alito was asking. Then the question got into rap music. And before we even get into that, Michelle Faust, help us understand, again, Alonis and his attorney are saying, well, a lot of what he was posting on Facebook, he's just quoting rap lyrics,
yeah,
right?
The assumption is that he is an aspiring rap artist in the style of Eminem. So Eminem is being discussed when it comes to this. And there, in the amicus briefs and the friends of the court briefs, there was a lot of discussion about the freedom of speech when it comes to art in the form of rap and violent rap lyrics.
And so, you know, you pulled a 30-second cut for us to listen to, and I think, I mean, I'm sure it's clean as it can be.
Well, the thing about it is, that was one thing that I wanted to tell you, is when I was trying to find a cut from Eminem, it was very difficult to find something without using certain expletives. But I was finding some of the violence more offensive.
More disturbing, yeah.
And more disturbing than the actual expletives.
Well, let's listen, if we could, to a cut from Eminem. And again, this is, I guess, technically more protected, right? This is considered art and entertainment. Let's listen to that.
I'ma tie to the bed and set this house on fire. I'm just gonna stand there and watch me burn. But that's alright, because I like the way it hurts.
So the interesting thing about this song is that this song was on the top of the charts, played on all of the radio stations with a little bit of creative
and
editing.
And that's Rihanna in there?
And that's Rihanna. And that's the other thing that's interesting, is you have a person who is very well-known victim of domestic violence, and then you have someone who has made threats against his wife in the form of rap in the past. And I just wonder, when you're hearing the wording, the lyrics there, he says, I'm going to make it better. I'm not going to do that. I'll use the violence against the drywall in the home. And then he says, you know, actually I'm lying, and
yeah,
I'll
apologize,
tie her to
even though
bed.
I know it's lies.
Exactly.
Right.
Does this sound like typical domestic violence scene?
Oh, for definitely. I mean, you have elements of domestic violence episode. It might be sexual violence, emotional, physical violence, followed often by the perpetrator making promises of changed behavior, to never do it again and to cease the behavior. Let's face it, by the time the helping professionals get there, this apology has already happened, and it's too late in some ways. I've said earlier, you know, most victims fall in love with someone who they believe is a good person and who has turned on the charm and persuaded them otherwise. When they start to see the behavior that's negative, it's often after they're involved in a relationship, either emotionally, physically, have a child in common, have, you know, bank accounts, web, or homes that are co-owned. So I think that, you know, these apologies that happen after a violent incident are very, very typical.
And I don't want to go down too much of a tangent here, and I also don't want to be the guy in the room who sounds like someone who's against art or First Amendment, but I hear this song and I think, I don't even know why that's okay. I mean, you know, I know it's art, I guess, But it makes me terribly uncomfortable, and I guess that's a discussion for another day. But the connection to this case, again, is that, look, Anthony Alonis is styling himself as Eminem would. That's what this was about. And so let me read what Justice Alito wrote or asked about that. During the oral argument, Attorney Elwood, who appeared on Alonis' behalf, Justice Alito quoted from one of the Facebook posts regarding a shooting and a kindergarten, which has formed the basis for one of Alonis' convictions. What if, Justice Alito asked, Alonis had ended the post with the phrase, just kidding, just kidding, and then described himself as an aspiring rap artist in that post? Do you think, Alito asked Elwood, in a tone which strongly suggested that the answer was no, Congress really wanted the application of the statute at issue to turn on an inquiry into a really strange psychological state? Do we want to examine what makes for an actual entertainer or an aspiring rap artist? And Scott Maloof is an attorney. It is a strange conversation, but that's part of what this is sort of hinging on.
That's right. And the interesting thing is, in one of the amicus briefs, that case already is out there. And let me tell you, it's the case of an individual, and his name is Justin Carter, and this happened in Texas. He was playing an online video game with his friends, and you know, as part of a lot of these video games, you can chat, you can speak to each other, and they were arguing, and along the lines, it said, somebody called him insane. He said, "You have no idea. I am going to go shoot up a local daycare, and then I'm going to eat their still beating hearts." And then he followed it with, "Just kidding, LOL." And he published it to the others in the game. Well, unbeknownst to him, someone in Canada saw this and reported it to the local authorities. He's been arrested, and now he's released on bond. And that case is yet to go to trial. But what's interesting here is Alito was suggesting, you know, it's very hard to look into the mind of this individual. Texas is a subjective intent state in the sense that the law there does require that they look into his intent. Did he really intend to do this? And so I think those cases are out there already, and courts will have to do this, have this capability.
But how do you know? I mean, go ahead, Kate.
I think one of the things that Scott's raised, and I do think, while you feel it's going down a tangent to talk about art, Eminem, or I do think you have to put it on the table in this discussion today, because similar to online games, similar to music, similar to films, regular television, our children are inundated every day by violence. And I have to say, if you were to keep a scorecard, most of it is misogynistic. And we know that if parents are concerned about changing the tide and breaking the cycle of violence, paying attention to what our children are doing and what they are saying, what they're watching, is imperative.
You know, I I'm late for a break. We'll get to a break in a moment. We're going to get to your calls in a moment, too, if you want to join the program. I guess, Michelle, I'm a little shaken up by that Eminem song, because you know, you may know the song better than I do. I haven't listened to it much. But there isn't a moment in that song where he sort of steps outside of the narrative of the song, right, and says, "Isn't this a horrible situation? This is all too common." I don't think that's part of the narrative of the song.
That's not what I'm hearing in the song. But the thing about it, I think something we need to keep clear when we talk about misogyny and violence in music and violence against women in music, we can't just say this is a rap issue, because these are things, you hear this in a song, at least one song by the Beatles. We have that very famous Hey Joe song with Jimi Hendrix. This goes back very far in history, and I can name some songs mostly in Spanish that go back even to the 20s.
All right, let's take a 60-second break. We'll come back with some of your comments that are coming in online, by phone, 844-295-TALK. You want to join the conversation. And we're going to read what Justice Kagan has been talking about this week, which might give us, in her words, a middle ground. And, you know, I don't know, again, if we're looking to achieve that, but Justice Kagan has provided some of her thoughts. We get to those after the break right here on Member-Supported Public Radio. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In studio for the hour, my colleague Michelle Faust is here. We've got Catherine Cerulli, the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center and the Laboratory for Interpersonal Violence, and Scott Maloof, an attorney who helps other attorneys turn social media into evidence in cases. We're looking at the Anthony Ilonis case that the Supreme Court has been considering this week, and we're not going to get a decision on this until, what, next year, right? Probably,
that's
right.
Probably
April to June, something like that. But there's been a lot of analysis into what's going to happen. And Justice Elena Kagan focused most of her efforts on the oral argument part, trying to arrive at what she said a middle ground. She proposed what she described as, quote, a recklessness standard. And someone like Anthony Ilonis could be convicted, quote, as long as he knew that there was a substantial probability that his speech would place his ex-wife in fear, even if he didn't actually intend to threaten her. Scott, if the court goes in that direction, sort of the Kagan idea, what ends up with a recklessness standard, what would the impact be?
Well, I think that's going to be a tough one. The fellow justices were skeptical of that standard, and it's understandable because we're talking about a true threat, because that was a modification of a prior standard as well. So, you know, you can put modification upon modification, and eventually it's incredibly confusing. I think the other issue, and this was addressed in the brief from Mr. Ilonis, which was that a recklessness or negligence standard moves away from what we traditionally have used in criminal law, which is intent. You know, if you kill someone, the court will look at, did you intend to kill that person? That's murder. If you killed them unintentionally, that's manslaughter. And so that recklessness standard threatens to do, in this free speech case, what you would do in murder. You'd apply a complete different standard, which gets a different outcome.
Yeah, so this moves away from intent very directly and by purpose. And what you're saying is probably not going to gain traction with her fellow justices because it's probably too murky.
It is. It's too murky. And you had a number of justices going back to looking at the traditional definitions of intent in criminal law.
Okay. Kate Cerulli, when it comes to what Justice Kagan is saying, she's saying, hey, if he knows he's going to scare her, even if he's not intending to hurt her, there should be some kind of penalty for that. I know that's murky. Is there a logical basis for believing that's a good idea?
Well, I would argue yes to some degree. I would be curious to know if your intent is not to carry out the act, but your intent is to cause fear. That is still a crime of aggravated harassment in New York, at any rate. And we know that for victims who experience emotional harm or psychological harm, that they have physical consequences even if they're never physically assaulted. And those include things at a cellular level, looking at fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, OB-GYN complications, pelvic pain. The way that stress impacts our health has been documented for decades. And we know from especially George Engel's work here in Rochester in the 70s, the biopsychosocial makeup of health. And that's why I was putting on the table earlier this notion of public health law, which comes out of Temple University. Scott Burris is a champion and developer of it, is looking at things like seatbelt laws, medical marijuana laws, any laws or statutes that you have that have a health impact. When you look at these domestic violence cases, even if the violence stops, you're looking at increased insurance premiums going out at what we know right now, 3 years post cessation of the abuse. We know this is costing our communities money based in the healthcare system, but Scott and I spoke before the show, it's also costing the private sector money, because when you look at perpetrators who are using technology abuse, they're often utilizing their workplace equipment, time, fax machines, computers, technology, cell phones. And when you start to think about how this creeps into our productivity in the workplace, there's broader ramifications than just public health law.
Okay, before we get back to the art question, which I think is important, let me get one phone call in, and then we're going to head back in that direction because there's just so much at play here. This is Tim in Pittsford. Tim, thanks for calling Connections.
Hey, Evan. My head's about to explode here. Just, I mean, for the normal average person, this guy is as guilty as you can possibly be. I mean, Scott, you sound like a great guy, but, you know, that lawyers seem to cloud the water a little bit. I mean, we're trying to give the guy who's threatening his ex-wife so many rights, and it's fine. I mean, he deserves some rights. He deserves representation. But in this case, well, maybe not in this case, he is in jail, but in so many other cases, what do we give the victim? A piece of paper that says this person has to stay 100 feet away from us or from the victim? I mean, how does, you know what you can do with that paper half the time? They don't feel protected at all. And also another situation, we all play armchair quarterback, which is great. This is something to talk about. It's very important. But I think more of us need to put ourselves in that situation. I mean, Scott, say if you were married, I worked for your wife, she fires me for whatever reason, and I post something like that on Facebook because I'm upset with her. What do you feel about it then, when it's a more personal aspect to it than, you know, someone across the country or, you know, not even close to you that you could just comment on it? I think a lot of people's views would change if it was a little more personal than that.
I think one thing I want to just chime in there real quick is that he did make mention in one of his posts about the protection order, saying if that you fold up that protection order, will it stop a bullet? That was one of the posts that was there.
Exactly right. But Scott Maloof, go ahead.
Well, I think the challenge is this, and personal is the right word. You know, I'm not the person, if I'm someone who's got a dog in the fight, I've been threatened, a family member's been threatened, to be making that judgment, because it's about society, it's about the rules that we apply. And cases like this, like we are all familiar with the Miranda rights that we hear from. You know, Mr. Miranda, when he was arrested, was a longtime criminal, and those rights were guaranteed to him even though he was a criminal. And that is because, you know, it's a test of who we are as a society, a test of what these rights really mean if we give them to everybody. If we start parsing them out and saying only a few people get them, then the rights really don't mean anything.
I do want to speak to the order of protection, Tim. While you mentioned that many people might seek an order of protection and what value does it hold, the evidence is pretty clear that protection orders, if drafted carefully and done well, and the science that's been done over now a decade and a half, they are effective in the 70s and 80s percents, depending on how they're constructed and how they're enforced. But the key word there is how they are constructed and how they are enforced. The important thing is that there is accountability when they're violated. And it's important for any victims that might be listening in on this call or any survivors listening in that you do need to take threats seriously and have a safety plan done and a danger assessment done to see whether the reality of these postings could result in the reality of action. And there's good scientific measures out there. So if you're listening and you fear something that's been posted about you, I would recommend you call Alternatives for Battered Women at 232-7353 and have a danger assessment done, someone who is knowledgeable about seeing whether those acts will be carried out.
And I think one more.
Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Go ahead, Scott. That was you talking, or Evan.
Oh, sure. One more thing, too, is when you are talking about a violation of an order of protection, it's a much clearer issue, and it's much easier to prove, as opposed to these situations where we're talking about speech, and now we bring in a whole nother level of issues. For example, there's a number of pro bono counsel, I believe, are working with Mr. Alonis. There's a number of amicus filing these briefs. If it was just an order of protection, we wouldn't see that kind of issue, and so things would be much clearer and much more efficient.
Tim, can I ask another question?
Go ahead, Scott? Tim.
I'm sorry, Evan. I'll go quick. Just kind of an opinion or personal thing, I guess, from a lawyer. What happens, say, Aloof wins this and things probably change after that? What happens if this guy actually goes after his ex-wife again sometime in the future? What do, from a lawyer's perspective, what does the lawyer that, say, represents Aloof feel about in the future?
I know Alonis is his name. You're conflating our in-studio guest with the actual defendant here.
I know, but I guess as laymen, we always wonder, what do lawyers actually feel about some of these, and I hate to use it, but some of these scumbags that they have to represent. Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Tim.
Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, there are two issues. One is whenever you're working on a case and like Kate, you're always trying to get everyone to the right result, whatever it is for them. And for example, Mr. Alonis, if he'd come to me early, I'd say, you know, maybe we've got to look at taking these things down, as well as you need to get additional help because this is not the appropriate way to be dealing with your feelings. But secondly, the important issue is, so often people need representation, and all the time they need representation because you're trying to fulfill and bring all their rights down. And for example, one of my big concerns about broadening this standard and taking the government's position is you will then see a lot of prosecutions come down. But in reality, you know, teenagers charged like Carter. And so what will happen is now the courts will be filling up with this. But these individuals, if they're middle class and they have an attorney, the attorney will say, well, to take a plea is X, to go to trial is X times 20. And so we're going to see a lot of individuals who take pleas for, you know, foolish statements that they make. And that's got a lot of reputational harm in the future, a lot of problems that would come from that. And so that's why a big concern is if you make the standard too broad, a lot of foolish people are going to have criminal records.
I think, though, that there's a second half to that, which is those individuals who are counseling survivors on safety planning. What can you do as a victim to protect yourself from cyberbullying and things like turning off your Facebook, not having it be public, not having different sources of communication to protect you, or blocking the perpetrator's access to your privacy technologically. That still isn't going to prevent the behavior of the perpetrator being able to make public anything that they choose to make public or go after. But I think that Tim raises an interesting point. What do we know might happen if this gentleman is released from prison? And one of the things is the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So if this person has a history of intimate partner violence and behaving in a way that is concerning, that behavior is likely to continue, which is why many victims ultimately decide to leave their perpetrators.
Okay. Richard writes into the program, very similar to Tim. How's this concept? Whatever you do in this world is a promotion of your intent. Whether done in the name of art or personal venting, it's still a promotion to whatever degree. So what you do in this world becomes a matter of personal responsibility. What is it that the world really needs? That's Richard writing. I think that's similar to what Tim said. My last question on this issue before we get back to where art is going is this. Scott's been talking about intent, and that's a huge part of this question. And this is the most extreme example I can think of. What if in the Alonis case, police ended up getting a tape, a privately recorded conversation however they get it. Let's say they are in possession of a tape of Alonis talking to his buddy in their car outside a bar. And he says to his buddy, privately, thinking it's not being recorded, you know what, I would never hurt her. I could never hurt a fly. I just want her to be scared because I'm upset that the marriage broke up, so I'm going to keep doing this online. Mm-hmm. Kate Cerulli, even if we believed that tape, is his harassment of her enough of a concern to press charges, to create legal issues, et cetera? Even if you had a tape of him saying, look, I could never hurt her.
Well, the intent in New York for harassment is the intent to harass, annoy, or alarm another individual. So the very placement of it on one's Facebook page, you know the intent is to harass, annoy, or alarm someone.
Scott, right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, so you still can't just do this even if you're saying, hey, I would never hurt her. There's still an issue there to begin with. Now, Michelle, we could probably spend an hour just talking about the way art expresses this stuff. But we've had a number of listeners writing to us during this hour saying, how come so much of this is directed against women? Kate said, made the same point too. So much of it's misogynistic.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting. I think it kind of plays to the larger question. Every time there's a school shooting, it says, people ask the question, do violent video games, does violence in film cause this? But a lot of what we hear and we see in media and in music, and I can cite all the way back to the 10s, 1910s of violence against women in media. Does that really have an effect on women? Does it have an effect on women who are victims? Does it inspire or instigate perpetrators to become more violent? What do you think, Kang?
Well, I think it's interesting that you raise these school shootings or, massive murder suicides, even the Army base and the college campuses and the grammar schools that we've seen. One of the things that is rarely talked about is in those cases of murder suicides is that there was an issue with a woman prior to that. Being scorned from a prom date, having someone break up with you, being hurt by a group of women, having a woman faculty member who male students took offense to, or that she said something in her class and that was a license to go in and kill a whole cohort in a department. So I think that the dialogue has to change from, one answer. We can't look at violence against women and say it's video games, it's art, it's pornography. We can't have a one-stop shop for this. The sociocultural levels that impact violence against women, from individual to relational to community to culture, we have to look at every single level of our socioecological model and say, how are we going to address violence against women in each of these levels.
But is it a contributing factor?
I would argue yes. And exposure, the science has come out with pornography, music games, videos. If you look at the video games that are now labeled, you have to be a certain age to acquire a certain video. There's been great controversy around the labeling of these games.
It makes me think of the young man in Southern California over the summer, and I'm forgetting his name at the moment, who actually did a shooting and killed several women. He had a long history of posting very violent things against women on the internet, on several different sites. He also had a long history of consuming this violent media. You know, do you see a connection there, Kate?
Yes, and I think that when we think about calling these individuals to the attention of law enforcement. We just got an article published. Corey Nichols Hadid's a colleague of mine, and the paper came out looking at protection order applications and whether protection orders were issued based on the level of danger that the victim told us that they were in. And lo and behold, when you had that temporary order stage, women who were in a very dangerous level based on an evidence-based risk assessment, 91% of the orders were granted at the temporary stage. But when you move to the permanent order stage, which could be anywhere from a week to multiple weeks later, only 52% were ordered the permanent order, even though they were in a severe danger category. So the question is, with these young men handing out these warning signs, how do we get them evaluated and assessed and an intervention before the tragic outcomes that we see?
And you heard Kate Cerulli say that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. In that spirit, Jody writes to us and asks, and I tried to condense part of what she wrote, but Jody is asking, essentially, we've been talking about resources for women in danger. Are there known treatments for men to make them essentially cured of this habit of abuse or threats? Kate?
Well, the long-standing intervention for the past 20-plus years has been called batterers intervention programs, and those are the national go-to psychoeducational intervention for men who are charged with abuse. That has been effective in about 50% of the studies.
50%?
50%.
I would have said
less. I know. That's 50%, and some of those studies, mind you, are self-report, so we don't know what the partners would answer.
Do you trust those?
The self-reports?
Yeah. Well, do you trust in general that the program is effective?
I would always triangulate my data. I would want to know from official sources, the attendee in the class, and a proxy source. But there is a researcher who's doing cognitive behavioral therapy for perpetrators who abuse, which includes looking at their substance, alcohol abuse, and the violent behavior towards an intimate partner. That's Carolyn Easton out of RIT. Mark Swager from the University of Rochester is looking at alcohol and substance abuse and violence in individuals who are involved in the criminal justice system. They may not be picked up for intimate partner violence, but many of them have experiences of both perpetration and victimization. So I would say that we have done a great job in estimating the prevalence rates, but we have not done as good a job of creating interventions that are evidence-based.
Got about 2 minutes left. Let's ask our panelists what they think. You know, it's never easy to forecast exactly what the Supreme Court's going to do. And again, we're not going to necessarily know until the spring what the Supreme Court is deciding in this case. But when it comes to the case, the Alonis case now, Scott, do you have an expectation now based on reading some of what the questioning has been and some of the way it's gone?
Oh, you always want a prediction, Evan.
I do. That's
I think we're going
to
see
only to hold you to it in the future.
I think we'll see a number of opinions. That is my guess, in the sense that Kagan will say, I'm writing for posterity. I'm going to put something out there that maybe 15 years from now people are going to pick up on and go, hey, Justice Kagan was right. And I think then the other judges, Alito, will be on one end, whereas Roberts will be on the other, and then they'll try and pick up other judges. So maybe three opinions here, and we'll be left with kind of a mishmash.
Interesting. Kate, expectation with this?
I agree with Scott completely. And the only hope that I have is that the great debates that went on the legislative floor for enacting some of these Violence Against Women Act statutes will be upheld, including violation of the interstate transmission of these types of threats.
And, you know, I do want to follow up and ask you, you said you do have a hope. Do you have a hope for it? Is there a best case scenario in your mind for the way this Alonis case goes?
That the conviction's upheld.
Michelle Faust, thank you for taking the time to work with us this hour. You know, I do have 20 more seconds to ask you. Are we doing a good job in the media reporting on these kind of cases, you think?
You know, I would just always toot our own horn and say public media is doing a good job, and I'm not going to speak to the other.
Yeah, that's. I think it's fair, but I also think I know of no colleague like Michelle who is comes into my offices and says, "Are you looking at this? We need to talk about this." And the nice thing on this program and with this station, with our goals and values, is that we devote time to that. So this is the first of many conversations, I think, about this case, but related issues as well. Scott Maloof always helps us understand what's going on in terms of the way social media is used as evidence. He's a local attorney. ScottMaloof.com, M-A-L-O-U-F. Scott, thank you for taking
thank you.
Time. Kate Cerulli is the director of the Susan B. Anthony Center and the Laboratory for Interpersonal Violence. And I wish someday we wouldn't need to have you in so often, but we do. And it's nice to see you again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Michelle, great work as always. Short break. We're talking autism next hour. Stay with us.